just a subtle little glimmer, some suggestion that you'd have me if I could only make you better, then I would stand a little stronger as I walk a little taller all the time. Because I know you are a cynic, but I think I can convince you, yeah, cause broken people can get better if they really want to, or at least that's what I have to tell myself if I am hoping to.
Afternoon, Vancouver. You're listening to Talk Recovery Radio on 100.5 FM. We're in the downtown east side, Vancouver, Columbia and Hastings Street. We're in our fifth year this year.
Wow.
My co-host, Mr. Darren Gaylor.
Hello,
everybody. Darren. How are you? How are you? Left me hanging there. Thanks, Darren.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Here.
That's the relationship we have.
We're on camera.
Oh, there we go. We got some people tuning in on Facebook Live. Hello. Last week's episode had 3,000 views.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and for those of you that follow us on Facebook, you know that all the stories are great, and there's no story that's better. When you're brand new in recovery, your story definitely is the worst, the best, and the most exciting. But in reality, they're all the same. And but Nico was our guest doing his personal story last week, and his brother posted on the comment, you know, apologizing. Like, I don't really know the history there. I mean, if you read in between the lines, obviously the two brothers must have used together. And his brother was like just making amends on Facebook and just apologizing. And there was this healing. And so I go to Nico. I'm like, Nico, wow, what was that all about? He's like, yeah, I haven't talked to my brother in years.
You're kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, I just got the goosebumps.
I know. It's pretty, like, we sometimes forget what we're doing here. We're just, you got microphones, we got clean clothes on.
Yeah, yeah.
I showered this morning. And, but really, it's like people are healing.
It's true.
It's pretty cool. I was just like, oh, you know, and so hopefully that relationship, you know, gets better.
Well, they say it often when we talk about, you know, especially with our personal story guests, it doesn't come with like this huge impact on, like, oh my, you know, thank you so much for sharing, you know, it just saved my life or whatever, you know. It's just friends are saying, you know, good job, it was great, like, but you never really know, like, the anonymous person out there that it's affecting. And yeah. And it, not to say that his brother's anonymous, but that's awesome.
It's like, pretty
that
cool.
Just makes me feel good.
Healing happens when we share. And that's why we do our show every Thursday. We do our show, like, I've got a busy day today. You know, I'm in the middle of a busy work week, and I'm really grateful to our two partners, Last Door Recovery Society and Westminster House. New West Recovery powers this radio show. And I get to take 2.5 hours out of my busy day to come on down to a radio show and talk recovery on air. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/talkrecoveryvancouver. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're on SoundCloud, we're on iTunes, and we're on the radio, 100.5 FM. So
you can't not get away from us.
No, you can't. I'm everywhere. Yeah, everywhere. And, you know, we'll talk to our personal story later on, Josh, who's in recovery, and, you know, we're trying to get into the studio. And, it's really sad. We've got one more minute here. Horrible numbers. You know, it's they've got the new numbers of 1,500 people in 2018 passed away from overdoses, and that doesn't include alcohol, and that doesn't include the people that are still alive but are in care for the rest of their lives. Thousands of people being affected by addiction, and the Liberals came out with their budget a couple of days ago, and I don't even think the word overdose crisis is anywhere in it.
Sad.
I just couldn't.
Or recovery.
Like, it's just, it boggles my mind. Like, I, you know, I have a baby that lives in my house, and like the government is spending more energy on measles right now, which is, they should, you know.
Don't get started now.
But they should, you know, like, they should. But Like, I just can't even believe thousands of families and all these people have passed away, and it's just not the number one thing on their agenda. So if you're a liberal, think about that. Anyway, Darren, who do we got in the show today?
I'm excited. Today on Talk Recovery, we get to Talk Recovery with June Ariano-Jakes. June is the author of Addiction, A Mother's Story. So not just an author, obviously, a mother. I was looking into a lot of the histories of you volunteer within the homelessness areas, dealing with addicted people. Before we get into the story, what is the situation with your son currently?
Well, on February 17th
of this year,
okay, he's 5 years clean.
Wow,
which is pretty remarkable. I am so proud of him.
No doubt.
I am so proud of him, because he struggled for 23 years with really hardcore addiction, to heroin and to cocaine and then crack cocaine and meth. It was a devastating addiction for him.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah. And a devastating journey for his mother, you.
Absolutely. And his brother and sisters.
Right.
Yeah.
There's, five children in total?
Yeah. Yeah. He's the second oldest. My kids range in age now from 32 to 47.
Okay.
And he's the second oldest.
Now, is there any other child of yours that suffered through addiction?
My three daughters, no. My youngest son realized when he was 26 that he was an alcoholic. And on that day, he had hurt someone's feelings. He's a really sensitive guy. I mean, okay. he's 6'5", fully tattooed, like, everywhere. And he is like Mr. Sensitivity, right? And he hurt someone's feelings when he was drinking. And he just said, I have a problem. Wow. I've got to stop. And he did. The day after, his brother stopped using, and they didn't know. So they've both had their 5 years. Pretty awesome.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah.
So now, as a mother, as it's in its beginning stages, I think there is a natural ignorance around identifying addiction, as a parent maybe that didn't grow up with it, or the quote unquote red flags that I think parents will then feel guilty that they should have seen or should have noticed. But there's going to be behavior that you're going to recognize is not my son's, not how I raised, you're going to notice some changes. What were some of those changes in the beginning for you?
It's really interesting, Darren, how we have evolved in the last 28 years as far as awareness of addiction and
right.
It's just phenomenal, right? I mean, back then, you were hard-pressed to even hear it talked about, right, on TV or read about it in magazines.
Yeah.
And today we're really aware, and we're aware that it's a disease process. And my son was two very, very different people. Like, my son, not on drugs during the period of time when he would be healthy. It would be like, take care of yourself, Mom. Don't work so hard. Be careful when you're out there, right? And then my son on drugs would be, fuck you, bitch. I hope you die, right?
Wow.
So there was these two very, very different people. And I was really mindful of, this is my son, and this is my son on drugs when his mind is altered. So I decided at that point I would never take personally anything that he said to me when he was using, mm-hmm. because that wasn't my son.
So how did you figure out that? Because most people are going to need, a clinical therapist to sort of guide them to that type of understanding or awareness.
I really can't give you an answer there. I just knew that my son was very different, and it would switch on, and when he wasn't using, it would switch off. So to me, this is a brain issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the wiring is changed, like a computer,
sure.
Right? And, at first it was things disappearing. It's really funny. like bikes were disappearing, you know, the snowboards were disappearing,
yeah.
Guitar,
whatever could be carried.
Yeah. And so, you know what I did? I actually put a little bit of barbed wire along the fence. And I even said to my son, someone is coming into our yard every night and stealing stuff.
Because it couldn't
and he
be
went,
him.
Never thought for a second, right? And it's like, but this time they're going to just like go to jump over the fence and they're going to get a scratch. And so they're going to go, oh, I guess we can't do this anymore. And he's going, good idea, Mom. Yeah. You know?
Sure.
And it's like, I'm giving him the inside information.
Yeah. So, okay, so this is, I mean, acknowledging the fact that he's using when you can sort of accept the fact that this isn't my son, this is, you know, there's something going on with his brain, I shouldn't take it personally. But how do I say it? Like, how did you get to that spot where it was almost like you're past the acceptance of what he's using? Like, when you hear he's using heroin, crack cocaine, like, I mean, did you want to just sort of, like, protect and deny and hide that?
No. I wanted to get him help. And at one time, I owned my own home. Today, I rent an apartment because over the years, I mortgaged and remortgaged my home to the tune of $460,000 to get my son into treatment programs. Mm-hmm. So everywhere that I thought he could get help, I was trying to encourage him to go. He always went reluctantly, of course. You know, he didn't want to get help. He thought he was doing just fine. And but it would usually be when things came crashing down, you know, either there was a pending court date or someone from the dark side was after him for an unpaid debt or something, where he would be willing. So I would jump at those opportunities to get him into a place. But And he would be okay while he was in there, mm-hmm. until he walked out the door.
So, as you sit here now, waste of money?
No.
How do you?
I don't regret that. A lot of people ask me that question, and I say to myself, it could have been at that time when he was off the street and he was in a safe environment that maybe saved his life at that time. That's just how I justify it.
Okay. What is your biggest regret or mistake in dealing with your son's addiction?
Well, my son was always so nice, right? Like, it would be, I'm sorry, Mom, you're right. Mm-hmm. If he had, but that, I know that's all part of manipulation, mm-hmm. because that worked for me, right? It's like, how do you get mad at someone who is saying, I'm sorry?
Yeah, who's showing
remorse,
right, yeah.
Right? And, you know, although it was part of the manipulation process, I also know he meant it. And I know that every single time when he would say, I want to stop, I knew he meant it. I didn't doubt that for a second. And I remember one time, Darren, we were walking and we were up in Wally, and at that time he was living on the street. He was homeless. And we've always had a good relationship in that whether he was living at home or whether he was out, we always stayed in touch. Like three or four times a week, we would talk on the phone or we would get together. And this was one of our kind of walk and talks. And he said, you know, Mom, I used to have hope that things would change. I don't anymore. This is my life. And I remember him saying, I believe I will die on the streets of Surrey. And so I said, well, then I'm just going to have to hope for both of us. And his comment to me was, you can't understand me, Mom, just love me. And I said to him, you know, my love for you is unconditional. It is exactly the same when you are using and when you're having brief periods of being clean. I like you a lot better when you're clean, but I love you exactly the same. And yeah,
that's profound. Because I mean, as a parent now, I mean, you sort of hear the unconditional love, mm-hmm. you know, but it's hard to really understand that. Because I find there are conditions.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I hope to mature and to you know, to grow. So that's profound. To sort of like, you're letting the possibility of you being able to do anything, you know, physically, in influencing him to live his life happy, like to just accept your son's going to live without hope, must be devastating for a mother, let alone the drug addiction. Like now you've accepted drugs are a part of his life, but now you have to accept the fact that your son is now a human being in life, living without hope.
Yeah.
Like how sad, that's probably the saddest thing.
It really is. Because I think as parents, and you would get this, as parents, we fix things for our kids,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
You know, the toy breaks, we fix it. They fall down, we kiss the hurt better. And all of a sudden, this monster is in your life, the monster of addiction, and all the love in the world will not fix that.
Yeah.
And that's the sad part. And you know, when you guys were just talking a few minutes ago about, you know, the number of overdoses and that it's not being talked about the way it should be. You know, when you think of that, if we counted the number of overdose deaths in Canada just last year, that would be the equivalent of 6 or 7 Air Canada or WestJet planes crashing. If 6 or 7 aircraft full of passengers crashed in Canada every year, would we be talking about it? You know, all the they would be pulling out all the stops.
Yeah.
Because this is unacceptable. You know, this is unacceptable. These are loved people and they are hurting. And one thing that I've really found is that through all the work that I do, there's only two reasons, really, I believe, that people use, but you guys would know more than me about this, but curiosity and pain. We recognize physical pain, but emotional pain is the one that's invisible, and it's the one that's most profound. Like, we have people being raised with domestic violence or sexual abuse or sexual assaults or feelings of abandonment or neglect or bullying or feeling you're not good enough. Like, there are so many reasons why people have emotional pain, and we're not addressing that.
Right. And that's the thing, the physical pain, I can see where the injury occurred. I can go to the doctor, I can get that fixed, and I can accept the fact that I'm going to have to wait a while to let that heal.
Absolutely.
And then it's going to be fixed. Emotional pain, you can't just go to the hospital, put a Band-Aid on it.
Exactly.
Right? And that's do you believe, like, as a mother that's obviously made phone calls, like, did he go to those places that do provide that treatment for that emotional pain?
Not to the extent that it needs to be.
What's missing out there?
I think, regardless of what we say, there is still too much of a stigma and too much shame, blame put on people that are struggling with addiction. Hmm. You know, we've come a long way, and I think the reason why we've made progress is because all of a sudden, people that were not addicts started dying. Occasional users started dying, and the tragedy of that for those families was like, they just used occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
It made people realize this can happen to anybody, because we talk about overdoses. What I think we should be talking about is a poisoned drug supply. Like, our drug supply on the streets are poisoned with fentanyl, carfentanil.
And the fact that, I mean, if I'm sure you've noticed, you know, with your son's addiction, like, it's the more and more and more. And what can never can get me higher quicker.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you can give me a safer heroin.
Absolutely.
But this over here is going to get me to how I really need to feel, and my tolerance is through the roof, so I'm not gonna give this up, right? Because addiction really doesn't see that. It doesn't want to be safe. It's gonna take risks, and it's gonna try to numb out with the strongest and boldest.
Yeah.
And how many close calls did your son have?
He had probably close to a dozen overdoses on the streets of Surrey and Vancouver. Surrey was his primary area.
And what do you do? How do you cope with that? Do you go save him? Do you go hospital? Do you bring him home afterwards? Do you just sit at home and just say, hey, that's his life. I hope he gets better.
No, I never did that. I was more the jump in and let's see what we can do. Let's get you into another place. You know, clearly you need this. I guess I hit bottom long before he did.
Yeah.
In that he wasn't ready, and I would have done anything in the world to get him the help he needed, right? But I learned a lot. I learned a lot. I learned that I don't give up on people. I've learned that I'm stronger than I would have ever thought I was. Mm. And I've realized how strong my son is, that he could survive what he did and come out of this all these years later. Like, I think of the number of times, you know, that he was beaten with baseball bats and metal pipes, the number of times he was stabbed and shot at. He was doused with gasoline by a guy trying to set him on fire.
Wow.
You know, he had been held against his will.
You would think he would go crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you cope through all of this?
Do you know what? I remember one time when he was missing, and I walked the streets and back alleys and checked the overgrown empty lots, dumpsters, everything, and I carried a picture, and I walked the streets all night long showing people, have you seen my son? You know, and because I thought he had kind of given up hope, but I couldn't, if he was going to be okay, if he was going to survive this, this ordeal, then somebody had to be reminding him of his value, of his worth, because he is a wonderful man.
So that wasn't your insane codependent enabling. That was your responsibility as a mother.
Oh, yeah. See, but I did crazy stuff, too.
See, that's the thing. Like, we've interviewed so many perspectives and opinions and professional, you know, opinions on a parent's position dealing with an addict. And someone we interviewed would have said, that's crazy. That's way too far. That's putting yourself in danger. Then there's somebody else that would have said, but that's what needed to be done for you to, you know, for someone to lay their head on their pillow that night, you know, to feel that that they did all they could. So there is no real sort of, this is how you deal with your child's addiction for any group of people, really. I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that your personality is showing something. Your sense of optimism is another side of it. How, like you said, how strong you started to believe you could be is adding to your own personal needs.
Yeah.
as to how to provide guidance and how to take this on. And it's going to be different than another mother.
Absolutely.
And it's
going to
be different than another mother. And
yeah.
I mean, that's, I think, the best message we can say out here is, I mean, first, I guess there's some self-discovery, isn't there?
Absolutely. And there's no easy answer,
what you're
answer,
capable
right?
of doing.
Yeah.
Without going completely, you know, out of your mind.
Yeah.
So that's amazing that was your response to how did you cope getting yourself out there, like right in the mess of it all.
Yeah. But like when you mentioned, you know, like sometimes you kind of go overboard.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. Like at one time I put my house, when my son was incarcerated, and I had turned him in when I realized he had robbed a bank. And so I turned him in to, number one, have him be responsible for what he did, get him off the street, and also prevent him from maybe hurting somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when he was incarcerated, he really came into his own. You know, he became healthy, and he his mind was clear. And I thought, okay, I'm going to sell my house, and I'm going to go and buy a ranch. up in the Chicolton, right?
Free range your son.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There's no drugs there. There's nothing. He'll be safe there. He'll be happy there.
Put the barbed wire to keep him in.
Yeah, yeah, right? It's like, that's how as parents we become insane, right?
Yeah.
And it's like,
makes sense.
He never in a million years ever said to me, I want to live in the wilderness, you know? Mm. But I'm thinking, oh,
you know what he needs.
I know what he needs.
He doesn't know what he needs yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So totally. Like, yeah. And in my book, I talk about, I mean, it is like the good, the bad, and the ugly. It's laid bare. There's just no, there's nothing. I mean, it is, it's just real, right? It is, there's no Hollywood version. It's not like all cleaned up and it's just, it's just real.
And I know it's why you wrote the book. It's what parents need to hear.
Yeah.
You know, like constantly they're seeking professional help. And often the downfall of the professional help is it's one-sided.
Yeah.
You know, it's, well, you know, interventions don't work. They cause harm. But this might, if some time was spent in learning the family, they might find out that, no, this particular case would benefit from an intervention.
Yeah.
Because there's countless results of great outcomes starting from an interventions, but there's also families that have got sort of destroyed from within.
Right.
So what I want to ask you is, okay, it's great your son's found some success and he's found some recovery. Did you find freedom before that? Did you find peace while he was still out there? Like, is there that potential, or does the son, the child, have to either, you know, find recovery and succeed in their life for the parent to sort of be able to take a breath?
You know, I don't know that I can even really give you an answer on that, Darren. It's I think we come to a point of acceptance of what is, but with the hope of what can be. And like, I never, ever went to bed at night without saying, God, please keep an angel on his shoulder until he can find his power. Mm. You know, and I know someone's power, I guess, people are not their addiction. You know, their lives are affected by their addiction, but they're not their addiction. And whatever works for one person may not work for another. You know, abstinence works for many people in a 12-step program. But for other people, you know, medically assisted treatment with Suboxone or methadose or methadone. And we have to also look at those people that have tried all those, have gone to the treatment programs, and still their lives are in shattered. If they need to have intervention in clinics where they can go in and get their prescription heroin or their prescription morphine. Everyone's thing might be different. Mm-hmm. You know, what works for one isn't going to work for another. But we can't just let people die.
Right.
So whatever help, whatever harm reduction we can provide so that someone could lead their best life. And your best life may be different than my best life. But whatever someone's best life is, they deserve to be able to live it. And, yeah.
And what can we say to a mother that's in it right now, that's struggling with, am I going too far? Am I spending too much money? Should I kick him out? Do I allow him to stay? Like, that just doesn't, that's going crazy from not knowing what to do. What can we tell her?
You know, I don't think there is an easy answer. What works for me might not work for you because we're all different. I just know, for me, when my son was making effort, he lived at home. When he was stealing and from us and you know, overdosing in the bathroom, it was time to go. Either I will help, I'll do everything I can to help you get well, but I won't ever do anything again to keep you ill. And I think sometimes as parents, we think, okay, well, I'll just help a bit with the rent so that they have a roof over their head, or I'll just fill the fridge with groceries. All we're doing is lessening the impact, right? But that's, again, that's just my opinion. And as parents, we have to do what we can live with. What you can live with might not be what I can live with. So we have to be true to ourselves in that way, too. There isn't an easy answer.
So well said. And I think that so many times, you know, people writing books and saying, I have the answer. And I think you just nailed it. Like, whatever you can live with, that's huge. But find some support and get involved with other parents that can, you know, that can understand. I mean, I'm 13 years clean. My sister's 7 years clean. My mom is still involved in the parent groups at the treatment centers that we went to.
Because
she knows that it's important for other parents to hear, you know, the struggle and the success and the hope and the lack of, and that everything you're doing isn't wrong.
Exactly.
You know?
Good for your mom. Yeah, that's important, right? Because that gives hope. When you're in a situation where you feel like, is there any hope? And then you have someone come in and say, yeah, I've been there. And my son is doing well. He's on the radio today. You know what I mean? It's that those things are huge, right? Because when you have when your kids are so deeply embedded in it, or your loved ones are so deeply in their addiction, it's pretty easy to see no hope in the picture, right?
Yeah.
And there is hope. But we have to embrace what's out there and embrace what's available and just make sure that we give people the opportunities to get well.
Beautifully said. June Ariano Jakes, the book is Addiction, A Mother's Story. There is hope.
There is.
There is hope. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us today.
Darren, thank you. And is it okay if I just give my website? Because
yes,
there's lots of information on there. www.addictionamotherstory.com. And I try and keep it updated with information for parents and other loved ones.
And you can get the book there and find out more about you.
Thank you
and your
so
story.
Much. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in and checking us out also on Facebook. Coming up, we'll have Josh share his personal story. And first, we're going to go with a little Neil Young. This is Helpless.
I have 4 amazing kids, 2 that are biological and 2 that I've adopted, that choose.
There is a town in North Ontario, extreme comfort memory to spare, and in my to go. All my changes were there. Blue, blue windows behind the stars. Yellow moon on the right. Big birds flying.
little Neil Young. Welcome back to Talk Recovery, Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. Welcome back, and again, back on Facebook Live, tuning in for our personal story with Josh. Josh is in the studio. Here we go. I love the personal stories, and this one shall be a personal story.
We'll see how it goes.
Josh, I'm excited, buddy.
There's Josh. Thanks for coming on the air tonight, Josh, and you're coming to us in studio live here. How you feeling?
Yeah, good, good. I didn't know what I was getting myself into here, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, you got to listen to the first half of the show.
Yeah,
so,
that's great.
I met your mom, and for those of you that are just tuning in now, the first part of our show was a mother's story of her son's addiction. How's your relationship with your mom's changed now that you're in recovery?
You know, it definitely has gotten better.
Yeah.
It definitely is still a tough relationship.
Okay.
You know what? It's still an ongoing process.
But you've changed.
I've changed.
Yeah.
You know, she's stayed pretty similar.
Okay.
Yeah. You know,
it's an interesting perspective because you come into recovery and it's like, you know, there's all these real life issues out there. They don't change. You have to change in that.
Of course.
So how long have you been in recovery for?
So my clean date's July 27, 2005.
2005. So you've got a few years under there.
Almost 14 in July.
14 years. That's amazing. We do recover. How old were you when you started your recovery?
I got clean this time. I think I was 23. And then I first started, you know, 6 months to a year previous to that.
Do you do 12-step recovery?
Yes, 12-step recovery, yes.
I usually ask this question to some people. Why after 14 years?
14.
Oh, yeah, I'm horrible at math. After 14 years, why? Like, why do you still do recovery?
Yeah, you know, I think about this stuff at times and assess myself and assess, you know, recovery and all this stuff. And, you know, I just know to my core that I'm not someone that can use and have a life, you know, and that's to the core. And I know what will happen if I use, and I don't want to lose what I have.
How about, do you think if you stopped doing recovery, when I say recovery, like do meetings and all that, do you think you would relapse?
You know what? It could be definitely a good possibility.
You just don't want to take a chance.
Of course, you know, myself, you know, I can only speak for myself. You know, if I don't go to meetings for a few days a week, stop doing recovery, stop hanging out with friends, offside behavior, I can not feel good about myself and you know, and not feel good in recovery, and you know, I know at that time, you know, that's a time when addiction can creep in, and you know, and it's not a good place to be. So I do my best to stay on top of things.
Yeah. What would you say is the biggest difference from the Josh now compared to the Josh?
You know what? You know, the Josh that I was before was the most self-centered guy, you know, unkind, only thinking about myself type of guy. And, you know, like today, I don't like talking about myself or saying positive things about myself, but you know what? Like I'm like a super, super nice guy. I'm willing to do anything for someone, you know, anything from my friends and family, just positiveness. So, yeah.
I'm glad that you answered that with self-centered, because whenever I usually ask that, that's usually the number one. Like, if this was Family Feud, that would always be the number one answer. But yet we're focusing so much on stigma and so forth, and yet the reality is, you know, the denial and self-centeredness is really at the core of my addiction.
Yeah.
And I'm just taking it, you know, from what you said, it's yours, but you never really hear that talk. Like, were you stigmatized? Was there ever that time?
What does that mean? Like, what does that
like
mean?
Like, before you, at 23 years old, yeah. like, what got you into recovery? Let's go from there.
You know, losing everything, no financial items, no money, no place to live. People were out to get me. I was getting robbed, abducted, held against my will, and wanting to kill myself.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
It's almost like Herson, the guest we had before you, almost it's a similar story. Yeah. But so all yeah. that was going on in your life, did yeah. you like, hey, I'm going to go to rehab, it's Tuesday, 9 a.m., let's go? Or were you like forced?
Yeah, you know, the thing for me at that time was I never knew about NA, 12-step fellowships, recovery houses. I never personally knew about any of this stuff.
And how did you find out about it?
You know, the way my story worked was I you know, my mom was the only person in my life. You know, I called to her for help, and she was the one who found a center for me to go to and flew me out to the center. And that was my first start of my first recovery.
Wow.
Yeah, or my first attempt to be clean.
And that was 14 years ago.
That was, you know, over 14, a bit over 14 years
ago. You know,
and
the sad truth is the reality is that's still the case in today's world, where if it wasn't for moms, you know, just, you know, hitting that keyboard, doing search, you ain't going to find really recovery unless it literally hits you across the face, which is sad.
Yeah.
And I know you do your part. You volunteer quite a bit and you help people, especially newer people are trying to find recovery. What is some of, now that you're in recovery, what are some of the challenges you have, like, helping people try to get to where you're at today?
Challenges, you know, really, like, of being clean for this long, I can do all I can do to help inspire people and help people, and but it's their individual efforts and you know, wants and their drive that, like, we can only do so much for that person. You know, they have to get inspired. They have to want to be clean for this to really work, you know?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's actually work that we have to do. Your dad.
Which I don't know.
Pardon?
Which I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
No?
No.
What do you mean?
I don't know my dad.
No, you're a dad.
Oh, I'm a dad. Yes, I'm a dad.
I'm just like, wait a minute, what happened there?
We can go both ways.
I am a dad, yeah.
And it's so great seeing you with your daughter, and she's beautiful. Yeah. What was that like, being a single dad in recovery? Because we talk a lot about single moms in recovery.
Yeah.
We've had single moms on our shows, I don't even know how many times, and they deserve all the support they need and all that. There's a Mother's Recovery Tribe, which is organized by our previous co-host, Francis. Shout out to Francis. Mm-hmm. You're a single dad in recovery.
Single dad.
Tell us what that's like.
You know, it's been working pretty amazing. The mom and I are just not compatible people, and it's healthier not being together.
And you have full custody?
No, we share her. We share her. So I have her, you know, a few days a week, and mom as well, and we share her, and it's just amazing. It's, you know, it's still very surreal. You know, I still feel like I'm 20 years old, and now I'm, you know, managing a little child or taking care of a child and you know, a little creature, and it's just she's just the most amazing, beautiful thing, and you know, you've seen her at meetings and stuff like that, and it's just, there's nothing like it in the world to have a creation of you.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I have a baby that lives in my house, and every morning before I go to work, there's that Uncle G playtime, and it's just it's the only thing in the world that actually gets me to focus on just one thing.
Yeah.
Because, like, even right now I'm on the show, I'm thinking about emails I got to send after work. It's just the way my head works. It's like, you know, it never shuts down, but, you know, it definitely breaks down the self-centeredness that we have in ourselves.
Of course, yeah.
And no, it's good that she never has to see you loaded.
No. I definitely would probably not be in her life, not have a life being loaded. And it's, you know, it's kind of a thing, you know, my last sponsor kind of said, it's like, what can we put in front of getting loaded? you know, like we got recovery, friends, children, job, career, you know, and it's just, it's putting these good things in front of us, and that, you know, that that makes recovery so full.
Yeah. I really want to touch on Josh from a few years ago.
Sure.
Okay, so I've known Josh for probably 10 or 11 years, not your full. And we had a guest on our show a while ago, and she said she found her voice. She said it like three times in a short interview. And I had to stop the interview because we focused so much on the drug use and we focused so much on the story. And it's like, how much does finding your voice have to do with your recovery? And it's almost like she said everything. It's and it, that's not in the treatment plan. That's not in, you know, not in the 12 steps. It's not like it's not in the Minister of Mental Health and Addictions, you know, platform to stop the overdose crisis. Let's help people find their voice. And I know you found a voice because I remember in the very beginning you were one of those people that would come to the rooms that was very shy, very nervous. Didn't want to speak in public, and when you go to 12-step community meetings, you know, there's a lot of talking, and you weren't really into that.
Yeah.
And then slowly, you know, there was, it became the conversation how you weren't that guy that wanted to share,
sure.
And then you found a voice. Like, one day, it's just like, was that Josh?
Yeah.
Like, was that Josh?
Yeah.
Did he just say that? And now you're talking on the show. I don't think you could have done this show 12 years ago.
Probably and not. No, I couldn't talk to a girl or anybody.
We tend to not. And so I want to put an emphasis on this because I think it's a huge deal while you're sitting in this chair. So how did you? What did you do to get to here?
Yeah, I can definitely comment about that. And you know, definitely, you know, as Giuseppe puts it about getting a voice in recovery. It's definitely been a huge process for me. You know, and you know, I'm just my personality is very introverted, you know, and but you know, in early recovery, the recovery I was getting and involved with, I knew I would be okay, and I knew I'm fucking staying clean, and you know, and I was okay not talking at that time. I knew I was okay, but it definitely progresses, and you know, where I, you know, have to find the voice, I have to share at meetings, I have to. Give back, and you know, I would probably say personally for myself, in the last 6 months to a year, is where I've really noticed getting more of a voice just in this last little part of time.
And that's 14 years later.
Isn't that
amazing?
Fuck, it's a pro. There's no.
Okay, stop swearing.
Yeah,
we're
going to
get in trouble.
Yeah, well, no more swearing.
One,
well,
two.
We'll
even the mom swore earlier.
Swore
I was like, but she's a mom.
Yeah,
it's okay.
We'll keep it down.
So it gets better.
It gets better.
It gets easier.
It gets easier, yeah.
So if you're like 6 months clean, you're 3 months clean, sober, person in recovery, whatever your label is. It gets easier.
It gets. It's flown by pretty quick for me. It's flown by. Yeah, it's good. I'm just, you know, trying to see, you know, anywhere I can be of service. I was actually just in New York City and Barbados just a week ago, and you know what? I went to a couple meetings in New York, and the first meeting I went to, the main speaker had not shown up, and you know, I'm the guy from Canada, and
they
and
asked
like,
you to
yeah,
speak.
They're like, hey, do you want to come? You know, do you want to? Can you be our main speaker? And you know, I'm just at this time where I'm, you know, have this really good self-esteem, and I'm just like, you know, I need to do more for my recovery, and yeah, I was the main speaker for that meeting, and it was just amazing, and feels so good to be connected to you know, be connected and share recovery and
purpose.
Yeah, purpose. It's
like the Josh that was self-centered very beginning. I mean, getting robbed, getting held against your will and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, having purpose is like this arm guard. You know, you're just like ready for the world. It's like, I can do anything because I don't have this big mess behind me, you know, holding me down and all that kind of stuff. And it's an opportunity for people to actually heal from your voice.
Of course,
and that's a great gift.
Heal from that, you know, and then myself healing from my past, healing from everything that brought me through the door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
we only got a couple minutes left.
Okay.
Let's take a look here. We're almost out of time. So there's We had a mom on earlier talking about her son's journey, enabling codependency conversations as well. And I loved what she had to say, whatever you're okay with. So you know lots of people in early recovery because you go to meetings and so forth. What's one of the things that you think us as substance users, you know, what is it that we... You know, if I'm thinking about going to use this week and I'm thinking about using this weekend, this recovery is not good, what's Joss's suggestion?
You know, come to a meeting and reach out and hang out and, you know, get to that meeting. Give me a call. Give someone a call. Connect. You know, get together. Get out of your head.
Get out of your head. What does that mean? For the person that doesn't know what that means,
it means
what does that mean? Because we have all these slogans,
all these sayings, and you know,
it
means get out of that addictive thinking, get out of that obsession to use, you know, get out of that, you know, so it's not just self-centered thinking. It's you know, it you know, just being with someone, going to do something, it makes us to stop thinking what's going on, you know, and it's...
Yeah. One of the other parts of recovery is we don't get everything that we want.
Yeah.
And life on life's terms, you know, friends die. And, you know, you said earlier that you don't know your father. That relationship hasn't been healed. But I know that when you're a newcomer, or you know, I'm around lots of newcomers, it's like I'll grab onto any story and make it the reason. I don't know my father. Mm-hmm. My mother doesn't love
victim,
me.
Victim.
And so
yeah.
What process did you go through, if we can tackle that in a
sure,
bit?
Sure, yeah.
What process did you get through to go get over the fact that you don't know your dad?
You know, my whole, I don't probably don't have time for all of it, but my, you know, my story is a bit different, where my mom had actually gotten a donor for me, so I can't ever know him. You know, so that was kind of my story, and you know, even a reason why I started using, and a reason why I got into my addiction of you know, being raised as not a normal kid in not a normal family, and you know, among other things. But yeah, that's
pretty cool.
Yeah, that's my,
I'm glad I have a father, but I feel like, yeah, I'm a donor kid.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely affected me in a negative way for a lot of my life.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just mention this, like I mentioned I was just in Barbados, where I had done a DNA test 6 months ago, and I actually matched with someone who turned out to be my half sister.
Holy smokes.
From Ancestry.com, and did a DNA test. And just, you know, last week I was in Martinique meeting her for the first time.
Holy smokes.
So,
what?
I thought you guys all knew about that.
No, I didn't know about that.
So, you know, it's... and actually, she had somehow tracked this donor dad down. And the donor dad is, you know, a lung doctor in Montreal, and has four of his own kids, and she just did another DNA test and supposedly matched with another someone, and yeah.
So. Well, we're gonna talk about this.
Okay.
Yeah, we only got 30 seconds.
That's okay.
Like, thank God you're clean for this.
Yeah, thank you.
And you were able to get this done.
Yeah.
All right. We got Josh's personal story. Thank you, Josh. Congratulations on over 14 years clean. And we're going to close the show up. Darren, how are we closing the show up?
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. This is a little Fleetwood Mac. Don't stop.
Don't stop. Okay. I got to hit play.